Woof. Well met, and welcome to episode 37, the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March 28th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com. Greetings. This is Bill Walthall, and this week we're going to return to our usual type of programming from last week's kind of detour into weirdness. We're going to wrap up our month-long discussion of The Two Gentlemen of Verona this week. We'll discuss a production concept, create a possible cast, touch on a few final critical opinions, and then do our usual recap of this week's blog entries. Well, let's kick this week off with, ironically, or at least not fittingly, a few final words on the play. First of all, this is my least favorite of the plays thus far, both within the genre of comedy and in the canon as a whole. I find it forced and rushed, not at all well thought out. The conclusion is hasty at best, inconceivable at worst. I cannot fathom how Sylvia can maintain her silence for the last 114 lines of this play. On the other hand, this play has given me one of my few points of agreement with Harold Bloom, the major American literary critic now nearly 80, from Yale University. He hates the play too, saying that its only value comes from its introduction of the characters Launce and Crab. Bloom says it's probably the first play Shakespeare wrote based upon his amateurish writing. Of course, we need to remember that this comes from the same guy who sees Love's Labour's Lost as the first of the great comedies. Right. Now, according to another Shakespeare critic and Oxford Shakespeare editor Stanley Wells, the play has succeeded best when subjected to adaptation, increasing its musical content, adjusting the emphasis of the last scene as to reduce the shock of Valentine's donation of Sylvia to Proteus, and updating the setting. Well, as we've seen in the play's production history, Wells pretty much nails it on the head. So if you have to change the play to produce it, why produce it at all? Well, with the rise of dedicated Shakespeare theater troupes, which have a need to produce all the plays in the canon, as well as the existence of established companies desiring to mount Shakespeare productions but needing to do something beyond the usual suspects of popular plays, for example, Midsummer Night's Dream, Romeo and Juliet, Henry V, As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Hamlet, Macbeth, etc., there has arisen a need for atypical Shakespeare plays to be produced. And thus, Two Gents is being produced more often currently than it was at any point since and probably including its composition. So, if it's going to get produced, how would I approach it? Well, given its rushed pace and penchant for turn-on-a-dime characterization changes, I think the way I would want to present the play is as over-the-top and ridiculous as possible, farcical, and very lowbrow. I picture blocky sets, literally blocks of various sizes, strewn over the stage, very non-realistic. Some of them could be lit from the inside, their colors changing with the mood of the scene. Yeah, for those who have been following along with the project, either reading the blog or listening to these podcasts, you know that this influence is one that I'm pulling from the California Lutheran University production of Pericles, mounted in November of 2009 by Professor Michael J. Arndt. I also envision a large blank canvas, and that's canvas with air quotes, of a backdrop, one onto which hand-drawn backgrounds can be projected. I see these as very childlike sketches, but this part of the concept is less well thought out than the rest, but I think there's something there that could work. Now, as for costuming, I see a maintaining of a faux Renaissance feel, not technically accurate in either fabric or colors, but in feel and vibe. And I want cod pieces, lots of and wildly varied styles of cod pieces. In fact, I see Proteus's cod pieces growing more extravagant and, well, bigger as the play progresses. For those who haven't seen any of the first season of the Blackadder series with Rowan Atkinson, so much better than his Mr. Bean stuff, but I digress. You probably get my drift. Think of his scary black cod piece. Yeah, I see a lot of cod humor here. Now, as I noted before, I'm lifting one piece of staging from the CLU production of Pericles. Well, my intellectual reappropriation doesn't end there. I'm going to steal or borrow from four other productions in my depiction of an entity who is not technically in the cast of characters, though he is mentioned in some of the dialogue. Love personified, that lovable cherub himself, Cupid. Now, the cherub concept was used by Don Taylor in his production of the BBC Collected Works series, and the concept of an onstage Cupid was used in the 1971 musical by John Gare, Mel Shapiro, and Galt McDermott. Yeah, I see the onstage action overseen by Cupid, as played by a very large, very hairy, middle-aged fat man with stubbled beard, chomping on a cigar, dressed in a large, of course, baby's diaper, and wearing a stained wife-beater undershirt. His costuming is capped off by two things. One, a pirate's eye patch. You know, he's half blind, you see. And two, a white satin beauty queen pageant sash with the word Cupid across it in pink and sparkles. You know, break out the bedazzler. But instead of a bow and arrow, I see him carrying a freaking huge inflatable hammer. You know, like a Thor hammer. And he uses that to change the affections of the characters with a bop on the noggin. And I think I'm borrowing this from one of my former students' presentation of the eye juice sequence from Midsummer in one of our Nights with the Bard, back in the day when I was still a high school English teacher. Cupid is, of course, invisible to the characters on stage. Every time someone changes affection, Cupid is there to whack him on the head to initiate the change. In fact, I could see the play open up in a silent tableau with Cupid just beating the living bejesus out of Proteus. Now, I'm not sure if I want Cupid wandering on stage whacking people as they move about their business. I kind of think I want him to freeze the action, then come on in, whack him, and go off. And if I go with that freeze approach, he'll freeze the action by belching and restart the action by farting. But of course, that may be going too far. You're shocked, I know. I know you are. Not. So, if you've been keeping count of my conceptual thefts in relation to my Cupid, you know I've discussed three burglaries when I warned earlier that I would be doing the five-finger discount four times. Well, here's the last. Borrowing from a 2006 Courtyard Theater production, a collaboration between Nos do Moro from Brazil and Category 37, Birmingham, England, my dog Crab will be played by a human. Now, what does this have to do with Cupid, you may ask? Go ahead, ask. I'll wait. What does this have to do with Cupid, Bill? Well, the actor that plays Cupid will also play Crab. When he switches characters, he'll flip over the white beauty pageant sash and reveal its brown reverse. And then he'll don a goofy hat. And I mean Mickey's friend, not just an adjective here. But of course, that reminds me of a joke, but it's way too bawdy for this non-restricted podcast. Anyway, the goofy hat comes complete with large floppy ears that hang low. And across the front of the hat, instead of saying goofy, it says crab. Now, when Cupid is Crab, Lance can use the sash as a kind of leash. I see the actor playing Cupid, Crab, as occasionally doing a slow burn to either Lance or the audience, taking the cigar out of his mouth for a moment and clearly enunciating, woof.
Woof. Woof.
Okay, there's one thing I need to discuss before we get to the cast, and it's one thing that if I leave it out, I'd feel like I'm cheating, not really doing the concept or you, my dear listener, justice. What would I do about the gift sequence? Well, I see Proteus tearing the sash from Sylvia's dress as he begins to threaten her. I'm picturing a red sash. Then Proteus ties the sash over her mouth as he begins to move his threats from the general to specific rape. When Valentine saves her, he unties the gag and kisses her. Cupid belches. Freeze. He bops Proteus on the head. Cupid farts. Unfreeze. When Proteus repents, Valentine kisses Sylvia again. Belch and freeze. Bop Valentine. Fart and unfreeze. As Valentine begins his speech, he ties the sash as a bow under Sylvia's chin and into a great big bow on the top of her head, like she's a present. The bow keeps her from opening her mouth as he scoots her towards Proteus. After Julius swoons and Proteus rushes to Julius/Sebastian, Sylvia tears the bow off her head and begins to take a wild swing at Valentine. Belch freeze. Bop Sylvia on the head. Fart unfreeze. She continues to swing her arm, but now it flies behind Valentine's head and draws him into an embrace and a kiss. After Sebastian's revelation as Julia, another belch freeze, a bop to Proteus, fart unfreeze, and we're coupled off. It's a pretty gassy scene, especially since we still have Thurio and the Duke to get gassed as well. So, in this crazy, gassy, over-the-top setting, who would I cast? Well, I'm glad you asked. As my good guy Valentine, I see Dule Hill, who first came onto my radar in the West Wing, but is currently one of my son's favorite actors playing Gus on the cable series Psych. Great demeanor, even better comic timing. He just seems like a nice guy, but with enough snap to his quick wit to make his first and second act appearances more fun. As the ever-changing Proteus, I need someone who is immediately likable, but who can turn on a dime. It's a tough and pretty much thankless role, especially since by the midpoint of the play, we think he's a scumbag and we feel we'd probably be best without him. And yet, we need to, if not like him, at least accept him. And more importantly, believe that Julia has accepted him at the end. Now, who's got that kind of range? Well, Neil Patrick Harris, that's who. Great comic timing, great comic sleaze from How I Met Your Mother, and good physicality. He's just awesome. Now, for Proteus's much-put-upon love, Julia, I'd love to see Mila Kunis. Of course, I'd just love to see Mila Kunis in anything. Or nothing at all, but I'm bummed. Damn, she's hot, and with great comic timing. But as anyone who's seen her in That 70s Show or Forgetting Sarah Marshall can attest, she can also play very strong, perfect for the character who is willing to dress as a man and venture forth to travel to find her love. As Julia's waiting woman, Lucetta, I want someone a little older, a little more worldly wise, a little more experienced. The witty Lauren Graham from Gilmore Girls and The New Parenthood, as well as the wonderfully bawdy Racy Turn in Bad Santa, would fit perfectly. Whip smart, quick-tongued, she brings this perfect, slightly salacious vibe to the character. As Proteus's comic servant and dog lover Lance, I'd want someone not only funny, but also not stereotypically handsome. Someone who can seem a bit put upon, but not depressed about it, just kind of resigned to it, maybe even content with it. In Curb Your Enthusiasm's Jeff Garland fits that mold perfectly. And the idea of seeing him lead our fat, hairy Cupid by the brown sash like a leash, and maybe even scratching his wife-beater stretching belly, well, it just boggles the mind. As the Duke of Milan, I'd want someone who can play oblivious pomposity and self-satisfied attempts at trickery with equal aplomb. Think Glengarry Glen Ross meets Jack Donaghy from 30 Rock, and you can see where I'm going with this. Alec Baldwin. He's the boss, and he wants to think that he's cool and the smartest guy in the room, and to a certain extent he is, but we're still smarter than he is. And finally, as the Duke's daughter and Valentine's first love, Sylvia, I see Kate Hudson. She's a little sly and a little headstrong. She's attractive and blonde, a nice contrast to the stunning and darker Kunis. We need to see what Proteus sees at the end, and even for a little bit during Act 3, that Julia really is the more beautiful of the two. Now, with that cast and over-the-top direction, this could be a fun, bordering on wacky night of theater. And I think this is the way to go with this particular play, as I just don't see any straight version of the play being either fun or satisfying. It's weird. I'm not a fan of the play, but I think with this kind of approach, it could really make the play fun. Now, if you've enjoyed this podcast but you haven't been following along with our daily blog entries this week, you've missed out on subjects including Rip It Up, Baby, The Gift That Keeps On Giving, I Love You, You're Imperfect, Change, Who Knew From Verona to Milan Was the Roadmap for the Future, Rushing to a Conclusion, Less Satisfying, Love's Labor's Lost or Two Gents, Discuss, and When, What, How? So, if you'd like more in-depth discussions, or just want a daily fix, check out the blog entries at thebillshakespeareproject.com, or become a fan of our Facebook page. Remember that the Facebook page is more for Shakespeare news than the daily discussions of our play of the month. Also, if you have any questions or comment about this or any other Bill Shakespeare Project podcast or blog entry, you can always lob me an email at bill@thebillshakespeareproject.com. And of course, please join us again for our next podcast. We hope to see you then. You've been listening to the Bill Shakespeare Project podcast for March 28th, 2010. For our blog and previous podcast episodes, check us out at thebillshakespeareproject.com, and we shall see thee anon. Woof. Okay, you know that joke I was talking about earlier? Here it is, slightly cleaned up. Divorce court. Mickey Mouse is on the stand. He's getting a divorce from Minnie. The judge looks over and tells Mickey, "Mickey, I'm sorry, but stupidity is just not grounds for divorce." And Mickey says, "But Your Honor, I didn't say she was stupid. I said she was effing goofy."